My name is Noreen Tomasi. I'm the director of the Center for Fiction, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you here tonight for the presentation of the 2010 Clifton Fadiman Medal for Excellence in Literature. But before we do that, I'd like to take a second to talk to you about the man that this award honors. Clifton Fadiman became the editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster at 28 and the book critic of The New Yorker at 29. His books include three essay collections, Party of One, Any Number Can Play, and Enter Conversing, a guide to classic literary works that I'm sure most of you know, The Lifetime Reading Plan, and more than 20 anthologies. In 1993, he received the National Book Award for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. Though Clifton Fadiman was one of the 20th century's foremost critics, essayists, and anthologists, he viewed his primary occupation as reading, and what an astute reader and selector of books he was. He spent more than half a century on the editorial board of the Book of the Month Club, longer than any other judge. During his years at the Book of the Month Club, he championed Vladimir Nabokov's Speak Memory, Lewis Mumford's The Myth of the Machine, Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, and many more. So that's why it's especially fitting that his life is honored with an award that brings recognition to worthy books and is so involved with the process of selection. We think he would be so pleased to have an award in his name that encourages great writers living in the U.S. today to reread the books that they love and choose one to celebrate. We can't think, honestly, of a better person for that task than our selector this year, Jane Smiley. I know that neither she nor Jamaica Kincaid, the writer of the magnificent book she selected, need an introduction. The very distinguished body of work of these two writers speaks for itself. But I hope you will join me now in welcoming Jane Smiley. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a wonderful occasion for me to be here. And, you know, I started out life as a reader, not a writer. And so as I get older and I read more, I discover that reading leads to reading, leads to reading, leads to reading. We live in a time of many, many, many wonderful books. And I'm sure that as soon as we're finished here, we'll all go home and read. Some years ago when I was reading books for 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, I noticed that one of the greatest qualities of the novel and of fiction in general is how geographic it is. In almost every case, we readers open to the first page and find ourselves located somewhere in the world, and this place, new or old, results in a point of view, a perspective, an attitude, a body of knowledge that is rooted in that place, but transcends that place. For the duration of that work of fiction, that place, whether it is London in Oliver Twist, or Tokyo in the Makioka Sisters, or the Ukrainian steppe in Taras Bulba, is the center of the world. Everything there is large and vivid, and everything else in the world is far away and dim. Along with the new geography comes a new consciousness. As readers, we can't help experiencing this. Surely, people in Iowa think differently from people in Melbourne or people in Paris. And yet, it is in the nature of fiction to bypass or maybe transcend appearances, to set beside those very exotic enticements that caused us to open the book another thing, which is some sort of universal sympathy, some sort of emotional connection to the characters. Let me contrast this to movies. I may eagerly watch Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall on the screen and hope that they get what they want, but I never forget that they are Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall and that they are different from me in every way. But if a Charles Dickens is successful, I do forget that David Copperfield is different from me. In his desire to get away from Mr. Murdstone and the Blacking Factory, he is me, only he is me walking down a road east of London that I have never seen. It's a conundrum of the human imagination, how perfectly this works. Sometime in the 1980s, I read Annie John. I was living in Iowa. I had small children. I was teaching. I was too busy to pay attention to my reading program. But as with all books that one loves, I do clearly remember the images that came into my mind as I read the first chapter. An enormous sky, a power of sunlight redoubled by its reflection off the sea, trunks of trees, deep green leaves, lengths of white fence, small girls in crisp dresses. Maybe because I had daughters, I entered equally the consciousness of the girl and the consciousness of the mother. In the most economical way possible, Kincaid communicated the nature of the mother-daughter bond, the fascination and love that the daughter feels that is repeatedly betrayed by the mother's most automatic, natural, and responsible actions. This is what love is. I had never read anything like it. And then she went to a new school. Love expanded and grew more complicated. I remembered that, too, from my own childhood. I had read other stories about girls in school, especially by Colette, but I never recognized those stories as clearly as I recognized this one. The terrible immediacy of the best friend, the drama of every clothing choice, the sense that a spot in the schoolyard is one's very own home. And that bad girl, too, the one in strange clothing who represents to the child not the sort of socioeconomic failure or bad luck that she represents to the parents, but possible choices that could have been made but were not. A dress, a red dress, but also not being perfect, not doing well, being free. Once again, I read Kincaid's novella as a mother and as a daughter, and I was astonished by its frugal profundity. But of course, what Jamaica Kincaid has is not only her story, but her style, which is or seems to be, because every style is a construction, utterly direct and reliable, evocative but honest, a true representation of her own thoughts and judgments as possible, a new thing, a picture of a new place portrayed by a new consciousness. Why was I so impressed? Why did this short novel stick so firmly in my mind? Because it spoke to me, but was something I could never have produced myself or even imitated. It was beyond me. The Fatimid Award is sometimes used for resurrection. A wonderful piece of work has disappeared and deserves to be revived. But Annie John has not disappeared. It is recognized, read in schools, respected. But for me, asked to choose a book for this award, how could I overlook it? It was the first work by a member of my generation that struck me as new, important, and revelatory. My generation isn't so young anymore. When I reread Annie John, I'm struck again. Every word is just right. The place is caught, revealed. The child is bodied forth. The feelings remain startling and true. That Kincaid has returned to and modified her portrait of this place and these people over the years only adds to its brilliance. The second thoughts make the first thoughts more profound and interesting. Hers is a career and a voice worth celebrating, and tonight, this is what we are here to do.
Put it down. It's just the kind of thing I will do. Drop it. and then it would break and a whole set of things would occur to me. I'll put it down. I don't know what to say. I didn't know what to say. I never know what to say when these things happen because they're so wonderful that they seem as if they ought to happen to other people. But I have noticed, I said this to Jane, it's really true, I've noticed often that when something wonderful happens to me, something that I am completely not prepared for, it's truly wonderful. Forgive me, I have actually, at 60 years of age, braces. Very embarrassing. I have noticed that when something wonderful happens to me, the name Jane Smiley is somewhere around. I have noticed this, and so for me, Jane Smiley is a good thing. It's a wonderful thing. This is a great honor, and I thank you very much for it. And I actually wrote something to say, because I thought it would be better if I told you something I seriously had thought about than... Though I find that saying something, writing as if I'm going to say something, is not as satisfying as writing something that you will read. And so I've written something that I'm going to say, and it doesn't satisfy me as much as if I thought I was going to leave it on your chair and you would read it. So what I wrote is this: as much as a surprise to me that this book is still considered worthwhile, it is as surprising to me, is what I mean, as that I wrote it in the first place, because nothing about it was meant to be, not its author, not its author's life as she became a writer. I wrote it, but how? It is, in its brief way, a story about a mother and a daughter. It is a love story between these two people. That they became estranged is inevitable, because that is mostly the way of love. You love, and then you are estranged from love. It is also about a political situation, this novel. I did not understand that so explicitly at the time, and that is just as well, for then the subtlety that is the book would have been lost, and it would have been a different kind of book. And maybe it should be a different kind of book. I did not understand anything when I wrote it. Less than 20 years or so before I wrote it, I had been cast out of that paradise into which I was born, a paradise where many people today take a vacation. I never quite got over this, and almost every moment I got, I talked about it over and over. I talked about how my mother did this and that my mother did that. And my childhood was my only topic of conversation. People avoided sitting next to me. People avoided me altogether. But I didn't mind that. I found new people, and then I told them all the things that the other people had avoided me telling them. The psychological need I had for my mother must have been great, and it must have been quite clear to everybody but to me. At the time, I did not have a family. I was all alone in the world, and perhaps that is why I talked about her so, my mother. I needed her. All the same, I couldn't have her, and that was overwhelmingly so. So perhaps this book is also an account of a negotiation. I negotiated my way to independence. Countries, little ones, ones that start out as colonies, do this. Annie Jones is often described as a coming-of-age book, and it must be so. I couldn't have known about any other kind of life but coming-of-age. People who grew up in colonies often only know coming-of-age. I didn't know until I was around 19 or 20 or so that people still wrote books, serious books. I knew of Mills and Boone's romances. I knew of silly things that were in the covers of books, but I didn't know of the serious thing called a book. I did not know anything modern, not any writing done in the 20th century, the time into which I was born. I thought serious writing, literature, was something that people used to do but didn't do anymore, like a style of clothing that wasn't suitable anymore, that went out of fashion. I accepted it. It seemed right that just as I came along, this great thing no longer existed. The world was so much better when I wasn't part of it. But then I decided that it didn't matter. I had wanted to be Charlotte Bronte. I had wanted to be a little girl from England. That was sort of like wanting to be a fairy tale, but I wanted it anyway. But then I stopped wanting to be a little girl from England and started wanting to be Charlotte Bronte. I had read Jane Eyre. It had been given to me as a punishment to read. It had been given to me to distract me from making an ass of myself. It had been given to me so that I would not subvert a classroom of other girls. I read Jane Eyre, and I wanted to be not Jane, but her creator. That was the last time I wanted to be anyone when I was a child. The last thing I wanted to be was Charlotte Bronte, and I never wanted to be anything else after that. I had lived in a hot climate, but when I read somewhere that it's the author of Jane Eyre had lived in Belgium and had suffered some while being there, I began to wear too much clothes and carry myself in a way that made me think I was her, and I was somewhere in Belgium. It's the somewhere that is important in that sentence, and Belgium is not at all. A book gets written and then it's forgotten about. At least that is the way it is with me. I write a book and then I forget about it. The books I remember are the ones I haven't written yet. Each sentence of those, the ones I haven't written yet, I commit to memory. But then here comes this, the first thing I wrote of any length, Annie John. I'm not reminded of anything in it so much as I'm reminded of how good it felt to be new. Not young, but new, and not new to anyone, only new to myself. I could hear myself think. I could hear myself speak. I knew what I wanted to say, and I didn't care that it might not please anyone at all. That it was met with some delight and understanding surprised me. It is now so accepted that just the other day, when I was reading the New York Times, it was on someone's list of things they will never read again. And I actually can quote you the thing the person said because it's something I found funny. He said that his professor had given it to him in a comparative writing class, and he had found the experience of reading me tiresome. And his tagline was, bye-bye, Jamaica Kincaid, you will always be homework to me. I thought that was so funny. I am very grateful for this award, this medal, named in honor of a great man, white and dead at that, I'm sorry to say, in American literature. In that sentence, it's the American that's important, for this novel about a young girl coming of age on a small island in the Caribbean has become part of the American canon. Thank you.